Today on Databook, we're bringing you a spy story.
Complete with a daring or kind of clumsy hack.
Either way, it was a story that shocked the entire world of baseball.
That's right, baseball. This is the hacking story, the data story that rocked Major League Baseball. And believe it or not, it ties into healthcare.
But first, our story begins in 2011 with a baseball executive named Jeff Luno. He had just left his job with the St. Louis Cardinals, who was settling into a new gig with the Houston Astros.
He was the team's general manager. That meant he was top dog. GMs do a lot of things. They negotiate trades, oversee player development, and decide who gets or loses a spot on the roster. What's important is that GMs deal with a whole lot of data.
Salaries, margins, player statistics.
And of course, sabermetrics too, advanced analytics.
So before he went to the Astros, Jeff Luno had made a name for himself because of how he had used advanced analytics to scout and develop young players.
Back in 2003, he got his job with the Cardinals because of his knack for gathering and making sense of data. He could get insights that led to real action and real change. He wasn't the pioneer of baseball analytics, but he was a pioneer.
And baseball was a pioneer of actionable analytics in general.
It was, and it still is today.
Anyway, Jeff Luno didn't have much of a baseball background before he started working for the Cardinals. His resume kind of consisted of high school ball, and he certainly hadn't worked in the big leagues.
He was a consultant, a business guy. He had an Ivy League degree. He spent some time at McKinsey. He even founded a tech startup.
But he knew data, and he knew analytics.
That didn't always sit well with the old garden baseball. They were used to pine tar and dip, rough slides into home, and post-game beers in the clubhouse. They played baseball the way they thought it was supposed to be played.
So before Jeff Luno jumped ship, some guys in the Cardinals clubhouse had even taken to calling him the accountant or Harry Potter. He was a dork.
You see, for years, baseball relied on these gut feelings and instincts and statistics that often didn't really have much to do with anything.
But Jeff Luno and this new breed of general manager, well, they saw things differently. They employed advanced analytics. They tried to throw out the subjective or arbitrary data points that, in their view, had plagued baseball for way too long. Then they pulled in all sorts of other cutting-edge statistics, and they were all designed to get a fuller picture of a player.
And naturally, a fuller picture of a team. All of a sudden, the numbers showed that baseball clubs could do very well by playing a more strategic kind of game. Small, analytics-driven baseball.
And that was pretty lucky for the owners. That's because the data showed that baseball teams didn't need to go out and pay loads of money for every star. They did not need to sign every big-name home run hitter. They could build their lineups in a different way. They could strategically fill gaps. So what that meant was that players who were once overlooked, all of a sudden they seemed pretty valuable, and that was all thanks to analytics.
In the mid-2000s, Jeff Luno began to convince some people in St. Louis that there was something to this approach.
Well, the evidence was pretty obvious, if you ask me. The kids in the Cardinals minor league system had won 5 championships, and Luno was the guy who scouted and drafted them. He built those winning teams.
And he did it with his data, his analytics. So it wasn't surprising that other teams wanted him. Baseball's a transient sport. The best talent rarely stays in one spot, and that includes executives, especially the ones who know their way around a data dashboard.
So Jeff Luno essentially takes over the Houston Astros, and he starts trying to rebuild what was a really, really bad team. Capital B in bad. Luno does what he does best. He fiddles with the farm system. He starts scouting young talent. He's planning for the future. And he's looking for opportunities in the numbers. And the Astros start getting better.
Everything seems like it's going according to plan.
Until June 2015, that is.
June 2015 was the month when baseball erupted in scandal. The first report came out of the New York Times saying that the MLB was investigating the Cardinals, one of the best teams in the game, for hacking the Astros.
One of the worst teams in the game. And the case unfolded pretty quickly.
The MLB zeroed in on a man named Chris Correa, who had worked with Luno previously. He was the Cardinals' scouting director. soon the FBI was getting involved.
It turned out that Correa had hacked into the Astros' online scouting databases. He did this in 2013 and 2014. So Correa had somehow used Jeff Luno's old password to learn which young players the Astros were watching, how the Astros were evaluating those players, and a bunch of their secret analytical approaches. Through it all, Correa somehow managed to keep his identity and location a secret.
But eventually, he confessed to the crime. He got 3 years in jail and a lifetime ban from baseball. And the Cardinals were fined $2 million and two draft picks, too. A lot of people complained that the punishment was too light.
That's because nothing like this had ever happened in baseball. Cyber espionage was for international hackers, for James Bond villains. Yet, here it was, in America's game.
All the talking heads said it was the dawn of a new era, and they're probably right. Stealing signs on the bases had always been acceptable, even back in the old days, but now it looked like cybersecurity strategies might become just as important as the ones that managers were using during games.
And you could understand their concern. By the time the news of the hack broke, analytics and all things data had become pretty mainstream in baseball. It was common for my nerdier friends to talk about WAR and WHIP. Pro baseball clubs had hired data scientists. But that was just one part of the evolution.
Just like in healthcare, when data become crucial, so too does cybersecurity.
And make no mistake, data and analytics are crucial to baseball. Just ask our friend Jeff Luno. Last fall, under his leadership, the Houston Astros finally won a World Series. For the first time ever in almost 60 years of existence. And a lot of people credit Luno's analytics for that.
So if sports teams can use data and algorithms to win championships, what can healthcare take from them to improve patient outcomes?
Good afternoon, everybody!
Anyway, welcome to the second episode of Data Book, everybody. I'm your co-host, Tom Castles.
And I am not Chris Mad Dog Russo, I am Jack Murtha.
And today we're discussing the rise of advanced analytics in baseball, but we're not just talking sports.
We're here to discuss how baseball sabermetrics and analytics relate to healthcare.
So the Cardinals-Astros hacking scandal isn't the only indicator of just how numbers-driven baseball has really become. In fact, there's a much glitzier, more well-known story about the dawn of the era of baseball analytics.
You might know it as Moneyball. But before we get there, let's introduce our esteemed guest, Neil Cudler. He's a Mets fan, but more importantly, he's a doctor. And he's been a healthcare executive for quite some time now. He's also been working with tech and data and, more generally, bridging the tech gap between clinicians and IT.
Now, Neil Cudler works for Vertitech IT. He's the consultancy firm's chief medical officer. So, Neil, thanks a lot for joining us today on Databook.
Thanks for having me, Jack and Tom. It's really fun to be here.
So before we get started, Neil, I just want to put it out there that I'm a Braves fan. I hope that doesn't ruin the interview for you.
No, it just points out one of your intrinsic weaknesses.
One of many, Neil. You got that right. So let's get started with baseball and Moneyball in particular. How did advanced analytics find their way into what is, by all accounts, an old-fashioned game?
Well, that's a fun question to answer in some ways because it does reflect back to my being a Mets fan. Sandy Alderson, who is now the general manager of the Mets, was in fact the general manager of the Oakland A's back in the early 1990s. And a young upstart, you might say the big show failed him, or he failed the big show. Billy Beane, again, drafted by the Mets in 1980, bounced around the major leagues and the minor leagues, and ultimately was assigned to another minor league team in 1991. He went to Alderson and said, "You got to give me something better than this," and asked to be made an advanced scout. So it was actually Sandy Alderson's idea that Bean begin to take a look at data, statistics that are ordinarily ignored or undervalued by scouts in general, and to go look for those diamonds in the rough, those players, possibly even as young as high school players, who are exhibiting some raw talent that may not be as obvious to the scout that goes simply by gut instinct. Over the course of the next few years, you know, the A's had a fantastic role in the 90s, and then later on had another role in the 2000s, largely because of Billy Beane's work. Whereas in the late 90s, they had one of the highest payrolls. In the mid-2000s, they had one of the lowest payrolls and reached the playoffs all the same from 2000 through 2003, and again in 2006. And this is pretty much attributed to Beane's sabermetrics approach to the game.
And of course, this whole sort of revolution was immortalized in the film starring Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill. But even better, especially for our audience, Neil, we're interested in when you started incorporating this kind of data-driven evolution in baseball into your view of healthcare and specifically population health.
It's just a few years ago, sometime maybe in the summer of 2015, and there was an invitation put out to present at one of HIMSS' big data analytics conferences. And a good friend of mine, Larry Shore, and I sort of batted around a few ideas, and he being a Cubs fan, and me being a Mets fan in 2015, we had two teams who were on a tear. And so we really kind of played with that excitement in the face of the challenges that we were meeting with population health. So the frustrations that we kind of were latched on to were as much buzzwords as they were processes. Things like big data, predictive modeling, population stratification. We've all been using those words for months to a few years by then, and yet we're not seeing anything yield of significance that was transforming the way we delivered care. And so we kind of took some of those concepts and shaved them down considerably and began to look backwards from a big data vantage point to a small data vantage point. Don't try to boil the ocean of American healthcare. Let's look at a hypothetical practice with a handful of providers who are committed to improving the healthcare and clinical outcomes of a subset of their population. And in this case, we chose to look at diabetes and diabetic control as a way into applying the concepts of sabermetrics.
So then, would that be kind of your baseball team would be doctors who are playing in this world?
Exactly. So the doctors were basically the managers of the team. The patients might be considered the team members, and the practice itself could be looked at as the league. And so you could do interleague competitions, you could do inter-team competition, or even look within that singular provider's practice to see what the dynamics of their outcomes, what their win-loss percentage is based on very common, very familiar data points that could still be potentiated to change process across a larger practice setting. We made up a handful of statistics. For example, we hypothesized that in a given practice of four providers, we'd call each team by the physician name or the provider name, but look at the sum total of the practice, and let's say there were 1,000 diabetics in the practice. How many of those patients were achieving a measure of control of their hemoglobin A1C? and choosing a well-accepted cutoff point of 7%. How many patients were below 7%? How many patients were above 7% would give that sort of win-loss standing for the league or the office setting. Alternatively, we also looked at how many patients would be out of control and came up with a percentage of representing those patients needing more attention. What we really want to do with sabermetrics, with this small data approach, is to drive improvement, not just one patient at a time, but really one provider at a time, because it's the provider who can facilitate change given the right tools and given the right actionable information. What we then realized is, just as in baseball, data like this are very dynamic. In other words, patients are coming in on a routine basis to get these tests performed, and rather than just acting by gut instinct in response to a single laboratory value, trying to take a sweeping look across time at which patients stayed the same, which patients improved, which patients showed a regression of outcome measures. And there, we're able to not only identify those dynamics, but also have an opportunity to identify what the processes are behind those changing dynamics.
So, Neil, what did you find?
All providers, this is a universal truth, have the most complicated patient population. I apologize to my colleagues, but I'm sure we would all say that about our own specific cohorts. Cynicism aside, what we did find was that there are inter-provider differences, not simply based on what medication would be ordered first, second, or third line, but what support would be ordered first, second, and third line, what follow-up strategies would be made for one cohort versus another, and that it was the type of attention, the type of intervention, the inter-appointment support that was provided that helped to drive improvements. Under uncovering those processes and differences in processes would allow for something akin to what we sometimes call academic detailing, where we would be selling a process from one partner to another, saying, look, you've got 200 diabetics, 30% of them are out of control with an A1C greater than 7. How can we help you, or what is it that's going on in this office setting such that your partner has 15% of patients over 7%? In other words, a highly successful and well-controlled patient cohort. What are they doing as opposed to what is going on with the less successful 30% over 7? So really, if you step back, what we're not doing, what this analytics approach avoids doing, is picking a static number and saying, go up, go down on X pill, but rather picking a string of numbers and identifying what is going on in that patient's life. Is it food security? Is it a language barrier? Is it side effects from medication, affordability of copays? What are those sort of fundamentals? And then on the other side, on the provider side, is the patient being appropriately instructed? Are they given the simplest medication regimen? Do they understand the appropriate diabetic diet?
These sabermetrics for baseball, they're useful for kind of a measuring stick for your own internal talent, your competitors, and your projections for the future. The same thing must be true for healthcare. We can use this to measure patient populations, measure the success of a hospital, measure the potential for success for various treatments. Where is it being used most often? Where is it being underutilized? And what's next for all of this?
You know, where data analytics is being used most often right now are in some of the toughest nuts to crack in medicine. How do we decrease emergency department utilization, a very expensive site of care, and increase access to the primary or urgent care setting? How do we predict which patients of a certain level of complexity, which of those patients will be admitted to the hospital? Again, an expensive site of care with obvious morbidity established. How can we prevent that? That plus moving the needle through improvement in performance and process by addressing these cohorts of patients.
Neil, it almost jumps out to me very much like in baseball. If you were to use your advanced analytics and all of this advanced scouting knowledge only for maybe the benefit of one player or the benefit of one position on the field, it wouldn't much matter if you're not doing it within the context of a team.
Right, exactly. And that's where big predictive analytics modeling is looking at some of the big picture flaws in our healthcare system around service and access. And those are manifested in emergency department and hospital admissions. Where we can use the small data pieces, as I'm suggesting in this model here, is in a smaller environment where the players and the managers are in the same room at the same time and can not manipulate, but rather gain insight into their own practice, into the practice of their partners, and into the lifestyles of their patients in order to be able to make quick adjustments, sort of intra-game adjustments, as we talk about in sabermetrics. We can do the same in the practice of medicine.
Well, Neil, we have to call it a day here on Databook, but thank you so much for joining us. And before I let you go, I just want to say, let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets.
For this week's edition of The Insight, which again is sort of like Databook's goodbye, we're going to pivot from baseball and turn to something in the news. Last week, it was reported that Under Armour, which owns the MyFitnessPal app, the very popular food tracker used by hundreds of millions of people, suffered a huge data breach. 150 million accounts. That's a lot. That's one of the biggest data breaches we've ever seen, period. Not just healthcare. That got me thinking about quite a bit. In fact, I wrote a column on it, which you can check out at hcanews.com. Tom and I thought it would be worthwhile to sort of dissect and explore this really frightening incident. Tom, what do you think? Does the MyFitnessPal data breach get at something that's a big problem with healthcare, or is it a problem with apps and digital health and maybe even wearables?
Well, I'd have to go with saying that it's something that's way bigger. I think at a certain point, all of this data is going to be integrated. Your personal data will follow you everywhere you go, whether it's to a mall, a strip mall, where the ads are going to be blasted out to you in ways that are intuitive and smart and informed based on analytics, or whether it's to your primary care provider. Eventually, your primary care doc will probably have a steady stream of information coming into them prior to your visit, and the continuum of care will be extended in such a way that apps like MyFitnessPal will be an integral part of them spot checking how you're doing. So I think that while right now this data breach was certainly a big deal and it affected, as you said, 150 million people, things like this are going to need to be patched up so that we can continue to progress. The more we allow events like this to happen and just stand by and say, wow, what an unfortunate thing that was, the more we're holding back healthcare as a whole.
What's scary to me is, like you said, the inevitable interconnectedness of apps like this. These apps are going to follow us deep into the realms of healthcare if the manufacturers and patients have their way, which I think they will, because you already hear about such cultural change being driven by patients who want their fitness tracking apps involved in their care, who want their at-home genetic tests involved in their care. So a lot of people use MyFitnessPal. It's very popular. And there are many other apps like it, and they're not going anywhere. Will apps like this be used as some sort of trapdoor into the larger healthcare system? I know you and I don't have the answer for that, but it's quite possible. I mean, especially when you look at the hackers can decrypt passwords and stuff. Well, a lot of people don't have strong password protection, and their password for their app and their username for their app might be the same as their password and username for their patient portal.
Really makes me wonder what sort of implications blockchain has for all this. Your data can follow you everywhere. If it's in a secure bank or a secure blockchain, and you're the only one with the key, and you get to decide who gets that key, could we prevent things like this? Could we prevent hackers from getting into that personal data? Am I just throwing a monkey wrench into the situation here?
Yeah, I would say quite a few people probably would hear this and say, oh, here we go, another blockchain thing. But this might actually be one of the areas where blockchain is most effective.
I know that blockchain probably isn't going to solve everything, but hey, if it gets us a leg up from having to get an email with a notice of data breach, nobody wants to get that. That'd be fantastic.
So anyway, that's it for this episode of Databook. Again, please check us out online. We are a healthcare analytics news podcast, so you can find all of our stories day to day, our big features, our tiny news briefs at hcanews.com. Also, check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Healthcare Analytics News. And please remember to subscribe. We come out every Friday morning. Until next time, let's go Mets. And I'm Jack Murtha.
Let's go Braves. I'm Tom Cassels.
Boo. Bye.